Hey, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Negotiation. I'm your host, Todd Embley, and on today's show, we chat with Elise Ribbons, an American actor, radio host, startup founder, and influencer in China who is also fluent in Mandarin. This conversation explores the landscape of influencer marketing in China, focusing on key platforms like Douyin and Xiaohongshu, their unique features, audience demographics, and the strategies brands can employ to effectively engage with influencers. The discussion also touches on the costs associated with influencer marketing, the importance of selecting the right influencers, and emerging trends in the industry, alongside predictions for the future amidst geopolitical tensions. Enjoy.
Chinese people have a real connection with certain brands, and they're not going to give that up for any old thing. Now, if a certain country officially annoys China or like calls China out or makes fun of it or something, then yes, the Chinese people will, a little bit like Canadians recently, say no to products from that country. You know, I've seen the shelves at a wine store in Canada where it's like, buy Canadian. We don't need any of that crap from California. And, you know, I can see that happening in China within reason.
Home to over 4 billion people, the Asia-Pacific region boasts one of the most powerful consumer markets on the planet. Not only is it home to half of the world's under 30 population, but it's also home to more than half the world's internet users. It's a market that no globally minded organization should ignore. But entering markets like China, Japan, or Southeast Asia is no easy task. Just ask the likes of Microsoft, Google, Uber, and Facebook. However, times are changing, and with the right partners, doors are slowly opening as more and more companies find success growing their key markets in APAC. I myself spent 8 years in China, mostly as a venture capitalist, helping early-stage tech companies grow in the Asia-Pacific market successfully. This show is dedicated to uncovering and examining successful Asia market entry and growth strategies by interviewing the experts who've done it before and truly understand what it takes to be successful in the region. My name is Todd Embley, and welcome to The Negotiation, brought to you by WPIC Marketing and Technologies. Elise, welcome back again to The Negotiation Podcast.
Thank you for having me on again.
So where are you in the world that we're recording you from today?
I am currently in the exotic locale of Lansing, Michigan.
Lovely. So it's as cold there as it is here where I am in Canada.
Yeah. It's like I just really cold. I had never lived in a northern climate like this during the winter, and it's really cold. Beijing gets cold, but not like this.
Yeah, I was going to say, and we're going to talk about that. And so the next thing I wanted to ask you about was an introduction to your China experience and how you, your journey, how you became involved with China, and you know, not your first time on the show, but like I know, you know, you've been a very successful actor. Incredibly fluent in Mandarin. You have had one of the most successful radio shows, you know, hosted out of Beijing in China. You are an influencer. You are launching your own tea house in Lansing, Michigan. You've been involved with charities. You helped run, voting for the American elections for American foreigners or expats in China. I've done a lot of the groundwork, hopefully right there for you try to simplify and maybe get a synopsis down to about an hour of like, how did you become involved with China? Everything that you may have done. See if we can do this in less than 4 minutes.
You forgot a couple of things. One,
I bet maybe. I did.
I used to work for the U.S. government and USAID way back when at the U.S. Embassy in Beijing.
Not that that's come up in the news recently.
Just a little bit. And then I also, for 9 years, was the an executive at China's largest private construction company. So I had the opportunity to travel everywhere in China. And most recently, I spent most of my time working either in the theater that I was working with or doing influencer stuff, which was very fun because I became a brand ambassador essentially for Sichuan tourism. And I got paid to go to random locations in Sichuan and eat amazing food. And it was definitely the job that was probably the hardest and also paid the least, but was the most rewarding. If you like food, you know.
Okay, Elise, let's jump into looking at and doing an overview of the platforms. Let's just start with the main platforms used for influencer marketing in China today, and then how they differ from the Western platforms.
Well, the biggest one is obviously Douyin, which is the Chinese version of TikTok. They used to be one company, and then they separated. Douyin is so far-reaching that everybody has it. Everybody. Not everybody looks at it every day, and most people don't create any content at all, you know, but certainly it's the one that everyone always refers to. Then there's like a Kuaishou, which is sort of like the peasant-centric version of Douyin, and it is much more heavily used by people in rural China, and it sort of pushes more rural China marketing. And then you've got Xiaohongshu, which used to be much more of a sort of glamorous, female-oriented, urban, upper-middle-class. It's expanded a lot more lately, especially with the onslaught of Americans that went on there a few weeks ago. It brought a lot of attention to people who maybe not previously used it, because I think a lot of Chinese people had not yet realized they could get onto Xiaohongshu and actually see the world. Because all of these other platforms, and I forgot to mention WeChat channels, which is also very big because everybody literally does have WeChat and uses it every single day for everything they do. They don't do email. They don't do phone calls. They do WeChat only for everything. So WeChat channels is also very big, but WeChat channels is probably the worst at monetizing, if that makes sense, because it is so big. They're not really good at figuring out why they should monetize anything, you know? Those are the main ones. It is, you know, and obviously every like Alibaba and Jingdong, they also have social media platforms as part of their buying. But usually what they do is they just bring in stars from other platforms to do special sales events, you know. That's sort of the
what
big
about PDD?
Pinduoduo. It's you know how we sort of make fun of Temu in North America for being crappy stuff that's not worth the time and effort to even just order it? Pinduoduo is a lot like that. I personally have never used it because it was such a pain in the ass. But my nanny used to use it, and more than half the time she'd be sending stuff back. Way more than half the time. It would just be such a dramatic, you know, level of poor quality. But it is, you know, it's still big enough and people like a deal. So, you know, it's still there. But
I still use it. I just go in knowing that I have to be very selective about what, like, am I going to be getting some clothes? No, not usually. Cannot trust the size or fit or quality of that. But there's some things. I mean, I've gotten such cheap drones for my kids that break, right? Like, there's just some things that China's good at. That I know, like some RC cars that do super cool things and stuff like that. And I'm like, you know what? Anything around electronics and things like that, they've got to kind of figure it out. And their battery lives are pretty okay. And
yeah, and Pinduoduo is very good about being like direct from factory to consumer. So you skip out all the middleman fees, which is nice. And that actually is how Douyin got big in the first place is you had these... formerly, you know, English teachers in Hangzhou who sort of got unhired because of the Shuangjian, you know, the double policy of no English lessons being allowed, you know, and them trying to, you know, push more Guoxue, you know, more Chinese studies. So you had all these New Oriental English teachers who are really good at presenting. And so they started selling direct from factory in Hangzhou to consumers. And it just became a big thing.
I want to dive specifically into Red and Douyin. Let's maybe explain the specific features and audience demographics of the Red Note, Xiaohongshu, Little Red Book. What makes them unique for influencer marketing?
Okay. So, Douyin is much more like an everyday thing. And there are a lot of news items that sort of get pushed on it, if that makes sense. So the rear of the end, like different local events, things that are both actively pushed by the government. Like if there's a specific, you know, food festival in Anhui that they want to talk about, they can make that a hot topic. And so then anyone who does a video on it, it gets pushed in the algorithm. And, you know, it's much more of a sort of like a a news replacement, if that makes sense in that regard. Like most news stations have a pretty strong presence on Douyin. Xiaohongshu, not so much. It's much more like every brand has a massive presence on Douyin and on Xiaohongshu. And it's where the fashion influencing really happens, makeup influencing, art and that sort of higher, fancier end things, because Xiaohongshu was created as sort of a Chinese version of the Little Green Book to help Chinese tourists overseas or, you know, foreign students studying in America. That's where the founder first came up with the idea, you know, and so a lot of restaurants, whether in Europe or in America, that cater to Chinese people, you'd find all the information on Xiaohongshu. You know, it was very handy for traveling. For me, it was like a much better guidebook than Lonely Planet or anything like that, even though I'm not Chinese. But Xiaohongshu has been sort of, it's changed a little bit in the last few weeks because of this influx of American users. And I've seen a lot of, you know, bigger American influencers sort of keeping up with Xiaohongshu, keeping up with Red Note, which is, it's interesting. It's nice, you know. Over the years, I've had the opportunity to meet some, I mean, I obviously know a lot of Chinese influencers, but I've met some big American influencers. And yeah, they're sort of enjoying, even though they have many fewer fans on Red Note, they're really liking this interaction with Chinese fans. It's Chinese fans are so much better than American fans. I cannot emphasize this enough. Like in America, I'm not a big deal. I've maybe got across all my American platforms, maybe, you know, 40,000 fans altogether. In China, I've got well over 250,000, maybe even, oh, it's got to be more than that now because I got a whole bunch recently. So it's maybe about 500,000 fans in China. And you get, and I've seen a lot of Americans commenting on this on TikTok, which was that, you know, the, I'm in an interview right now, so I'm sorry. Someone else in the building. but I've seen a lot of these influencers even posting about it. They're like, especially as a female influencer, your average DM is not going to be something you want to look at, you know, versus the average DM from a Chinese fan was going to be much more like, what was your day like? I'd like to learn about America. Please tell me. You know what I mean? It's just, there's a lot of genuine curiosity and that desire to genuinely connect. And I will say, like, so my Douyin fan base is mostly men, which is unfortunate in a lot of ways because it's hard to monetize. But it's why I do the tourism and food stuff. And why, for instance, the biggest campaign I had done recently was for Hong Kong. They brought me down to do tourism and especially like Disneyland and things like that, trying to get mainland tourists to be excited and interested in it. And it's because it's, you know, the male market doesn't buy as much as quickly, but when they do buy, it's big ticket items. So, you know, they have it very, there's a thing called Xingtu on Douyin, and it lists in very specific detail who watches your videos, how long they watch it, where are they from, every detail about them. Right. Because everyone has to use their ID to register, you know, so this isn't made up potential statistics. There's no catfishing going on with the actual stats, you know. So if you want to market in China, unless you are a high end fashion label, Douyin is the place to go to. And you can go through Xingtu and find your exact KOL for your exact market. It is very easy. They hold your hand in the process. So like if you wanted to find an influencer who is based in, for instance, with me, based in Chengdu, has a significant male audience from people in Chengdu, not just people around the country. So, you know, looking for people who have that influence in that city, in that area, you can target your audience so specifically. And then it will list the prices out. So I, as the influencer, don't have to engage in that conversation, which is also very nice because I obviously, being a commercial actor, I previously, when I'd taken on, like advertising gigs, you have to you know, there was no way to get a cut of the sales. You had to like bargain your price at the get-go. And it's always hard unless you're so super famous that, you know, you can just ask for those millions. It's like you're having to fight for every penny and it doesn't feel good. It's much nicer when, you know, you open up your app and there's like three offers saying, hey, come eat at our restaurant. We'll give you 5,000 renminbi. And I'm like, okay, you know, like that's much nicer. And so I think a lot of, especially micro influencers, they love that aspect of it. They get the face, they get a little bit of money and they get free opportunity and fun. And then they get a cut of sales, you know? So it's, I explored a little bit with TikTok here in America, and TikTok, the marketplace is nowhere near as refined as Douyin is. But certainly for anyone looking to market in China, don't bother with the others. Just do Douyin. Don't let any of these middlemen company try to upsell you on crap. You can do it yourself. It's really not hard. You need to be able to read and write Chinese. So maybe find a Chinese person to help you with that part. But yeah.
I'm definitely going to leave that little interruption that happened because it was so perfectly timed, just as you're talking about having like 500,000 followers and how popular. And then, oh, excuse me, though, I'm doing an interview right now. Anyway, where was I? That was just like so perfectly placed. I'm definitely leaving that in there. What are your thoughts on the popularity, as we've talked about, of Red Note overseas? Is it going to be sustainable?
I don't know if it's going to be sustainable. I do know that the very first weekend when the onslaught happened, the censors were going crazy because every media outlet in China has active censorship going on. Like Douyin is very sophisticated with it. There's so many sensitive terms you cannot use at all. There's ways people can talk around it, but also things like cleavage cannot be shown, right? Like if you accident, like as a... If I was doing some Peking opera stuff, right, and I was wearing a sports bra and a t-shirt, and at some point in time my cleavage showed, the video would get banned, right? It's not a sexy video. It's Peking opera, and yet it would get banned on Douyin. So I'm very aware of all this stuff, and I had posted a video on Douyin. It did fine. I think it was probably slightly shadow banned because they didn't want that topic to get too hot. But still, it went through. So I knew it was okay. And yet it took 2 days to get through on Red Note. And so I know they were freaking out. And I have a friend who works at Red Note, and she said no one was expecting it. And they had been able to sort of slide under the radar for many years because there's no politics. There's a lot of discussion on education. There's a lot of discussion on food and brands, you know, but it's not the, you know, the town square forum that Douyin and TikTok sort of are, you know, because the thing that is unique also is that in China, social media wise, WeChat is king, right? But the thing about WeChat is that it's a closed system. Only your friends ever see your posts or your likes, right? So if you and I don't have a mutual friend, they'll never see that I even liked your post. You know, they can't even engage in that interaction versus Douyin. It's totally open and public, right? That was the real thing about it, is that it was a genuine way to connect. I mean, it's one of the reasons I even got into it, because I was going crazy being quarantined. You know, I'm a very social person, but multiple times per year, you know, we were in random sudden house arrest. And I thought that Douyin was a great way to sort of see the other parts of China, get to connect with people. And I did not expect to get as big as I did, but it's been a very fun ride.
What about costs for brands? What could brands expect in terms of costs when engaging with influencers on platforms like Red and Douyin?
So it depends on what they're trying to do. If they're trying to create brand awareness, like for instance, Louis Vuitton would hire a massive KOL, do a big campaign that would have both offline and online elements. An example is that the theater I worked for had done something with Louis Vuitton, actually. And it was with Burberry. They did a project with Burberry, rented out this whole giant gallery space, turned it into this very cool weekend long club, right? Very cool. They had all these influencers come. No sales happened at all, right? It was just to see the things, to get the influencers, talk about them and put it up. There were no links even for these influencers to make money off of these videos on a secondary. No, you know, it was really just creating brand awareness. That's one way to do it. And then the other way is so super targeted and really just about getting sales to happen. And that they did, the Burberry account did on a secondary level on other platforms at the same time. You know what I mean? But it was a different thing happening. And so influencers can either be the ones doing the selling or they can be the ones spreading the brand. But it is honestly, unless a brand has a lot of money to throw around, it's much better bang for your buck to just directly get these influencers to talk about your product, to use it, to like it, and to sell it for you. You know, you don't have to pay them. You give them a cut of what they're making.
Yeah. So do it on a rev share type basis.
Yeah. Especially with micro influencers. So an example is that Dove did a campaign a few years ago, like 2 years ago now. And for Valentine's Day, they were pushing it specifically with micro influencers. So a lot of people sold it, you know, and maybe each person only sold 200 cases or something. But when you have 2,000 people who sign up to do it, and there doesn't have to be a limit, you know? So you can sort of instantly make millions of sales, but spread out, you know, all over the place. And then you've got all these other people putting their talent, their work, and you don't have to do anything as a brand, you know?
Choosing the right influencer. You just touched on that. What are the factors brands should consider when selecting influencers just to ensure that their marketing campaign is going to be successful?
Okay, so there's influencers who will be directly connected to a brand, and that usually has like an upcharge. There's a fee for that, and that has to be discussed.
KOL versus KOC thing?
Sort of, yeah. Because like the KOL, so let's take a step back. When I mentioned the Dove thing, Dove did not choose any influencer. What they did is they created a campaign and they just put it out there. If you have X numbers of fans, if you have X amount of engagement, you get this kind of cut. If your fan base is this much, you get a bigger cut, so on and so forth. And these are the items. You have to, as long as you fit the criteria, we'll send you the chocolates and then you do a live or you do a video and whatever you sell, that's what you make. And they don't choose anyone as long as you fit the criteria, you know? And it's so successful and so good that it's bad for influencers like me who really need the, I mean, I don't sell stuff. I just don't. I'm not good at it. I'm much more of the brand awareness and the brand connection and communication side, which is why I ended up doing so much work with local governments and tourism, because they really want people to see and experience and to connect with a place that you can't just buy right at that moment, you know? So they need more depth. But really, if you're trying to sell stuff, you want to do one of those basic campaigns through Xingtu, as long as the people fit the criteria, because no one can say anything that crazy. You know what I mean? Like, there's the infamous time when a certain person was trying to sell lipstick, and there was a cake with a certain shape on it on a certain holiday, which I will not mention. And that was a big kerfuffle, but usually it doesn't happen. So you can sort of assume that anyone who is successful enough to fit those criteria as a KOL with Xingtu on Douyin, that your brand is not going to be harmed by an association with this person, right? And I understand why brands are wary of that, but that's why when you get to the secondary level, like the KOL who your brand connected with, that's a bit different. And if they do want to pick those, again, through Xingtu, you can go in and you can pick all of the criteria you want to look at, like their market access, their personal age range. Like maybe, for instance, this brand decides we really want to get, you know, Chinese women between the ages of 55 and 60 who are lower middle class. So they're aspirational and they have enough money, but they're not wealthy enough to afford really nice luxury. We want them. And so then suddenly you get all of those people who have that market. Now, if you want to choose an influencer who is also of that age, then that'll bring it. Do you see what I mean? Like, it just pares it down for you to such a detailed extent. There are companies that will offer you guidance, which can be useful. But you can also do it all on your own, you know, if you spend the time with it. You do need to be able to read and write Chinese. They don't, I mean, maybe not write, but you have to at least be able to read Chinese because all of it's in Mandarin. But it's all available. You just have to register, you know, through the Xingtu as an advertiser, and you're good.
What about trends in influencer marketing? Have you noticed any recent trends or shifts in the influencer marketing space in China that international brands should be aware of?
Well, certainly the opposite side is true with Red Note. Suddenly they're advertising to Americans. Like suddenly they're, you know, I've had all these factories reach out to me saying, hey, we've noticed you have a shop in America. Do you want this? And I'm like, you know, I'm good. Thanks. You know, or, you know, just people trying to create a market opportunity there. But really, if you're just looking at China internally towards Chinese market, the trends are, as per usual, that, you know, those quick sales, they really work. You know, there's these influencers who don't even have that many fans, but what they do is they go on and they just can sell a lot of crap. And I say crap, I mean, these things are not nice things necessarily, but they're able to just, you know, I almost signed with an MCN. Are you familiar what MCN is? It's not multi, it's essentially the Chinese, I don't even know what the MCN stands for. Maybe media something network. I don't know. Either way, MCNs, and they use MCN in Chinese. They just use those three letters. It's any of these agencies that essentially own KOLs, and they act as their representative. So in China, you know, it's how you get your hukou. It's how you get your shibao, you know, your social security and healthcare and everything. So Chengdu is actually one of the bases for some major, major MCNs. There's like four or five of the nation's top are based in Chengdu. And, you know, so I've worked with them in various projects, never signed with any of them because they don't really know how to sign a foreigner. It's just, you know, hard with the system. But they have studios where there's, you know, the an MC, a KOL who only maybe has a couple thousand fans, but they'll be on there trying on a new dress every 30 seconds and selling them like hotcakes, making millions, you know. And they, it's like the QVC channel on a cocaine fueled, you know, daydream. It's in, it's really crazy to imagine until you see it in person, you know. It's just about volume of sales, you know. So there's that side of it. And then there's the more branding awareness side, the bigger side. So an example is a Baijiu brand that wanted to work with me. I didn't actually have to do any of my own videos. I came onto their channel and talked about it. And, you know, they had an event, right? And they paid me a fixed amount to do that. It's much more standard, old school style, because they also know people aren't going to be buying expensive Baijiu on a whim. You know, you're going to, you'll buy a cheap dress on a whim. You'll buy a cheap purse on a whim, but you're not buying, you know, something with face value. But, you know, for instance, car KOLs, that was an area I was moving into before I decided to move back to America. Cause I don't know if you know this, but I did race car training at one point with Maserati, which was insanely fun. And I'm a bit of a speed demon, so I liked it. And so I started to work with some car brands in Chengdu. But we never, you know, I moved back, unfortunately. But there's also this big market of car influencers, people who will then test drive and talk about it. And, you know, their fans will probably only ever buy one car, you know, and they're going to wait till they see the right car, but they will go to that influencer, you know. And so there's also that element of, I know you as a person and I trust you as an influencer, which is different than the cheap quantity sales. And those definitely a brand would have to, you curate them. Did I pack in enough information in a 10-minute segment?
Last question, a Pandora's box of a question, so to speak here, but
okay.
Future predictions amidst the tensions with the US and China, are overseas brands still popular in China? Will they continue to be popular in China? Your thoughts.
So there was, I was there when the government sort of officially said no more iPhones, right? So everyone suddenly had to get, you know, a Guochan, you know, a Chinese made cell phone. Everyone, you know, and any, whether it was government or private sector, like you had to be seen with one. You know what I mean? Like, so people, I mean, I had three phones in China. Everyone has multiple phones, you know? I think that Chinese people have a real connection with certain brands, and they're not going to give that up for any old thing. Now, if a certain country officially annoys China or like calls China out or makes fun of it or something, then yes, the Chinese people will, a little bit like Canadians recently, say no to products from that country. You know, I've seen the shelves at a wine store in Canada where it's like, buy Canadian. We don't need any of that crap from California.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can see that happening in China within reason.
Yeah.
You know, I think even at the height of anti-American sentiment during COVID, for very obvious, important reasons, because Trump was actively antagonizing China. Yeah. People still wanted medicine from America. They trusted an American brand over a Chinese made brand by a long shot. I don't think that's going to go away too soon, but so many Chinese brands are genuinely starting to outshine international brands. You know, whether it's, I mean, EVs, I think hands down, the best EVs in the world are Chinese. Mm-hmm. To pretend otherwise is idiotic. And I'm in Michigan, right?
I know.
They just retooled a giant GM plant. And I'm like, y'all, let me connect you with Polestar or something to be doing, you know, it's just, oh,
I know.
It's ridiculous how backwards it all seems, you know? But no, my prediction is that China is going to continue to do what China does, which is push forward and build for a future, because they have a government that can plan for 30 years down the road. Like that alone is a very powerful thing. No matter what you think of the government, the fact that they can make a plan that far in advance and follow through with it. You know, the plans that are coming to fruition now were made 10, 20 years ago.
Yeah. A lot of advantages. Yeah. And I mean, I would love to be the first one to open a BYD dealership over here.
Oh my God. Yeah. You'd make so much money.
I mean, I know. You know, the big news about DeepSeek and how that just, what was it, like $1 trillion in market cap from tech stocks, you know, even, you know, Google starting to be in a little bit of trouble, and like their Android in China, and the potential where Huawei can really kind of take over. And there's a lot to unpack. There's never a shortage of things to talk about around these parts on the negotiation, but for now I think we got to put a pin in this one with you. So Elise, thank you so much for coming on the show. We really appreciate your time today.
Yeah, thank you for chatting. It's been very fun. And to anyone out there who might be looking for a consultant in this area, I am available. While I'm drinking my tea in my tea house, I can very easily help connect you with the right KOL for you in China.
How do they find you?
Oh, wow.
Best place.
I guess best place.
And handle I can't give at my, best place.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, I don't know. Blue Sky. And that's just EliseRibbons.bsky, right? .social or something.
Well, it's a unique name. I'm sure they'll be able to track you down somewhere.
You'd think, but you know.
Well, again, yeah, thank you very much for coming on the show. For everybody who is listening audio only, don't forget to go check out the WPIC YouTube channel, where we would be live in video. If you're watching on the video, the audio only podcast is available at all your favorite audio podcast platforms. We'd love to hear from you. Podcast@WPIC.co. Let us know if you have any guest recommendations or if you have any tips or advice for the show in general. And please don't be afraid to give us a nice review, a 5-star rating, all of that kind of stuff. Helps feed those algorithm monsters so that more people can find out about our show and get access to this content with people like Elise. But from me, from Elise, and from everybody else at the negotiation team, thank you very much for listening and or watching, and we'll see you next time.
Growing a company is hard. Doing it in a foreign market, exponentially so. The best piece of advice I can give you is not to do it alone. When you start looking at the Asia-Pacific region for further expansion possibilities, and I sincerely hope you do, make sure you choose the right partners to do it with. My good friends at WPIC Marketing and Technologies have almost 20 years of experience helping brands, just like yours, enter China, Japan, and Southeast Asia. I hope you enjoyed this episode of The Negotiation, and if you're interested in being a guest or want to connect with me or any of our team, please reach out to us at podcast@WPIC.co, and be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.